everybody, and welcome to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to do something a little different. We're going to be talking to someone that started out as an elementary school teacher and moved to middle school, and then high school, and became a school administrator, and now is a full-time independent operator who goes around the country talking about discipline in schools, how to maximize parent-student interactions. And your name is Dennis Mitchell, and Dennis, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, Dennis, I've pointed you out as a sort of a private contractor dealing with education. But before we get into that, what brought you into education to begin with? When you were a little boy, did you say, gosh, I love school, I want to be a teacher?
Well, actually, you would think that because of what I do, that would be the route that I had taken. Actually, I was a lovely little child, but I was ADHD. But back then, they just said, you know, slow learner, what have you.
And tell us again, ADHD.
It's the attention deficit hyper disorder.
Okay.
So basically.
So there's attention deficit disorder, and then there's a
hyper
disorder
component to it, and I had it all. And so could not sit down, could not sit still. Teachers really just did not know what to do with me. I did not learn how to read real well in the formative years. So my school experience was actually quite negative. I was always behind, just never seemed to catch up. And it wasn't until after the military, I had a real good job working in Detroit, and it's an interesting story. I was in their management program, moving to the top. And I was literally sitting with some friends on the sofa, and there was a commercial on TV that we need teachers. And I said, boy, we sure do need teachers. And everybody looked at me and said, well, Mr. Moneybags, how about you?
Oh, you were making a lot of money those days.
I was making good money in those days.
In the military?
In the military, and then I went to work for General Motors because I lived in Detroit. They said, well, why don't you become a teacher if you think it's that important? So the next day I walked into work, turned in my resignation, and got my undergrad at Wayne State University and began teaching.
Just like that.
And
what was the first interaction that you – can you remember those first days when you're thrown into a school full of what, seven-year-olds, six-year-olds?
Oh, yes. It was interesting. The first interaction I had was actually a second-grade class, and the children are much more articulate than you think. And I did learn a valuable lesson. You learn that you do not pass out manipulatives before the lesson.
Tell me in the audience what that means.
That means that we were going to build something with little blocks.
Right.
Okay. So I passed those out first before the lesson.
Oh, I see. So you don't give people tools before you've told them how to use the tools.
We had said tools. Yeah. They were eating them, swallowing them, putting them everywhere. So that was an interesting interaction.
But and nobody told you that?
No. And that was the
So teacher
key.
Training wasn't necessarily so hot.
Wayne State's excellent at their training, but I think that most universities are lacking in the classroom management area because there's a thought out there that if you have a great lesson, that the behavior management will be there. And we have a lot of our young teachers today that they have great lessons, but they can't get through the discipline to teach it.
And so, I mean, it's interesting because the first job I ever had out of college was teaching at about, I guess that's, well, there were seven-year-olds, this much I remember, in a little mining village in northern England. And it was sort of a stopgap job because I wasn't quite sure whether I wanted to go on and do research, etc. But I remember, I mean, it was just tremendous fun for me. I loved the kids. They were bright. They were sharp. But the discipline wasn't an issue, I must say that. I don't remember any bad discipline, except I was very good with the board eraser. I could throw it really accurately. And in those days, that wasn't considered to be too venal.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
I remember the school administration, there was no plan. You know, I was just thrown in there and sort of made effort as I went along. That's no longer the case, I'm sure.
Well, unfortunately, it still is a lot of the case. When I work with our new teachers, I travel all over the country. And I do seminars and I do trainings for new teachers, I like to say that they're fresh out of college. You know, they're just fresh out of the wrapper, still smell like bubblegum. They do not know how to organize their classroom. They do not know how to structure it. They're lacking in the skills of procedures and policies and discipline. Unfortunately, the children eat them alive.
So discipline, what do you think, is one – I mean, you hear a lot of complaints about education. the students aren't doing well enough, or they are, but they're only being taught to take tax tests and things like this. But beyond and above all that, you think that there's a fundamental need for introducing a discipline in the schools, not the sort of the rigid discipline of the old school mom going around whacking children on the back of the hand or stuff, but an organizational approach to teaching.
Well, it's interesting that you say it that way. The word discipline has changed over the years. Discipline means to be discipled by somebody with wisdom, somebody with knowledge. But nowadays, discipline means an action, punitive. I will discipline that child.
Yes.
And so a lot of our teachers who are not trained in how to put together a training system or a discipline system in their classrooms, you know, a discipline system is a training system. They don't know how to do that. They end up getting stressed out. And then now, as we talked before, when you're stressed out, you're going to go gotcha style punitive. And you're constantly in this reaction mode, emotional mode, and you just can't dig your way out of it.
But your career is to go and train teachers. So yes. Where are you doing it? You're training them while they're getting their degree or subsequent to their degree? And if it's subsequent, does that mean that the education colleges are lacking something that they should have?
I'm actually being approached by several universities now in different states because they like the approach that we take. It's very positive. It's very balanced. But yes, I go to the actual school districts, and I can train one school staff. I can train an entire district. The Abilene Independent School District hired me to come in about 6 years ago, and we trained every teacher and every administrator there because we wanted consistency throughout the district. They're now ranked number 17 in the country.
In terms of what?
In academics. Because
just in terms of test results, et cetera?
Everything, because it all starts with consistency and control in the classroom. You can't teach that you have no control over.
All right.
And so we start at the basics. And what's nice about doing the training district-wide is that when a parent, child, you know, the parents are always going to back their child. And it used to be they could start doing school hopping.
Right.
You know, they're not successful in this school, so they go to another school. Well, once they found out that we're doing the same consistent discipline program in every school, that was eliminated. Parents started getting in the program. And we also started training the parents with the discipline at home. We started helping the parents because they also needed help. It's not just teachers. It's adults and children in general.
So there's a sort of generalized system. It starts in the house. It continues in the school so that the child is sort of evolving in a system.
Yes. What we do is we give the parents and the teachers common language and common processes and procedures such that the child is no longer allowed to manipulate school against home.
Tell us what that means. Tell us how you perceive that these little children that we love so much really are just manipulative little devils.
Well, you know, it's funny. We talk about this a lot, that our children, when they do manipulate us, and they do, and manipulate means get their way regardless of anybody else's feelings, we have a little phrase that I like to use. And it's not personal. It's business. I don't personally dislike you. I'm just going to say something to get you to give me what I want. And kids will manipulate. They will pit mom against dad, school against the home, teacher against another teacher, teacher against administrator. I mean, kids are going to do, they're going to say and do whatever it takes to get their needs met. It's not personal. It's business.
Give us some concrete example of, because this is a whole discipline in the bigger sense of the word, issue. So how do we evaluate what the child is doing, and how do you have the teachers and the parent react to different scenarios?
Okay, let's say that a student, we'll talk about a student first. Let's say a student is off task. Okay, they're supposed to be working independently at their desk, and instead of doing that, they're, you know, bothering the student next to them or what have you. The teacher will come over and redirect them. Let's get back to work. Child will immediately engage in an argument. I don't want to work. Well, sweetheart, you need to get back to work. Well, I don't think you should be able to make me. You're not my mom. You're not my dad. I mean, so they will start an argument that's unwinnable.
This is typical?
Oh, very typical. Very typical. And
they're argumentative little brats.
Well, because they know that in order to manipulate the adult, they have to get the adult to be out of sorts emotionally. So they're going to push your buttons. They're going to argue with you. They're going to debate you. They're going to do whatever it takes for you to throw up your hands and say, fine, do what you want.
So the thing there is, I think I've heard this expression, right? The idea is, child says word A, you say word B. Or let's say it's the other way around. You say A, the child says B, but if you come back with C, now this is a discussion, right? With interpretations as opposed to an edict.
We discuss with our parents and our teachers. There is no argument between an adult and a child until the adult opens their mouth the second time.
That's so true. You know, there's always – well, no, carry on.
Well, what we do
– See, I've opened my mouth the second time.
That's right.
I shouldn't have.
So what we want them – which is a great segue actually into, well, then what do they say the second time? And what we teach them is what we call a paradoxical phrase. A child knows what to do if you become argumentative or defensive. They know how to manipulate that. They'll get you so angry that you say, fine, go ahead and do it. Either way, they've manipulated you off of your, what I like to call centered, the fight or flight method. So what we do is we teach our parents what I like to call a BAM statement. B-A-M stands for bizarre and meaningless. It's just a statement and a stance that says to the child, we're not going to argue about this. So,
like bollocks.
Right. And the statement really doesn't make a difference. That's why I call it bizarre and meaningless. It doesn't matter what you say. You can say there's snow in the hills. But as long as they know when you say there's snow in the hills, that means we're not going to argue about this. There's favorite ones out there like, excuse me, I understand. There's other favorites. I have a teacher right now. I love her. She's teaches in 11th grade. Here in Texas, and she says, I'm sorry, were you attempting to find out the location of my goat?
And
the children just go, what goat? Basically, what she's saying is, you're not going to get my goat.
I mean, it sounds both entertaining and sort of logical in the sense it's going to diffuse
a
sort of discussion about things, but you got to keep saying it over and over again. I mean, well, at what stage can you just not say it again?
Well, exactly. There are the majority of the children, because children are success-oriented, they will use a strategy until it no longer works. Then they cut their losses very quickly. They don't have any loyalty to their strategies. So we talk a lot about the strategy of denial. A child will deny and deny. You can tell your child, sweetheart, you had a cookie. No, I didn't. Yes, there's cookie all over your face. I don't know how it got there. You know, they'll deny because they know that the typical parent will not exact any kind of consequences until the child finally admits it. Well, what we talk about is, well, if you're certain that they had the cookie, then don't go there. Just say, sweetheart, you had a cookie. And when they start into their denies, you just say, and having a cookie is against the rules. And this is the consequence. Love ya. And we're done. The next time that child takes a cookie when they're not supposed to, they'll remember that you no longer care whether they admit it. And their new strategy out of the box will be, well, Johnny made me have it. You know, I just found it. They'll use a different strategy.
God gave it to me. We have to take a break. This is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Dennis Mitchell, an educational consultant from Dallas, Texas. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. For a period of time on Earth, several different human species existed at the same time. Eventually, through evolutionary selection, we remained.
Several years ago, in a Siberian cave, scientists dug up fragments of a human cousin called the Denisovans. We knew they were related to Neanderthals, but the fossil sample, a bit of her pinky, was only enough for a rough DNA analysis.
That didn't deter a group of researchers who pioneered a technique which delivers an ancient genomic sequence that rivals the quality of a modern one. So now we know the fossil is a little girl with brown eyes, hair, and skin who lived 80,000 years ago.
Scientists extracted single-stranded DNA and generated 20 times more readable DNA, giving them an extremely accurate view of the sequence, which wasn't possible before.
The fossil confirmed Denisovans are a lesser-known sister species to Neanderthals. She also shares DNA with modern humans, specifically Papua New Guineans, showing that early human species interbred.
A comparison of the Denisovan fossil with modern human DNA sequences shows the two groups evolved in separate directions between 170,000 and 700,000 years ago.
Since that split, our DNA shows over 100,000 DNA sequence changes. Eight in particular involving brain wiring may explain why we survived and the Denisovans didn't.
With the new technology acting as a sort of molecular time machine, scientists can now analyze many ancient fossils to add to our evolutionary tale.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
We're back here with Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Dennis Mitchell, education consultant from Dallas, and we're talking about strategies to diffuse discussion with students and children. And, you know, I grew up with a book. I remember very vividly this book by Benjamin Spock. And the reason I remember it so well, of course, is because he, when I graduated University of Durham in England, he and Charlie Chaplin both got honorary degrees. And at the time, I wasn't enamored with the idea that these two people. But as I grew older and I began to have a tremendous respect for Charlie Chaplin and, I must say, Benjamin Spock, not only because of his book on how to raise children, which may be a good book or a bad book, we'll get to that, but also he had some very good political stances that I appreciated. But tell me, was Benjamin Spock, all my older children grew up on the basis of what it said in Benjamin Spock's book. They've been okay. They're successful.
His book had many good ideas, many great strategies. I do not agree with certain issues that he took as far as I talk about a respectful communication to anybody is something that's bottom line. Let's not cloud the issue with a bunch of hyperbole or a bunch of words that will confuse the listener. If you have respectful communication with somebody, that means that the listener will not get the false belief there's options. Okay, they're not going to get a false belief that this is a debatable issue. Mm-hmm. We talk about that where a lot of parents will, or even teachers, they will beat around the bush, as it were, when they're giving directives. There's a chapter in my book that talks about don't ask a question if it's a directive.
Right.
We're so conscious about, you know, being polite and stuff to this nature that we actually set ourselves up for consequences. We'll ask a student, sweetheart, could you please stop playing that and come over here?
So there's what's already some options. I don't know. Or perhaps not. Not right now. Perhaps later. Right?
Exactly. And when the child does go there, which they will, the teacher is now upset because the teacher was saying, listen, you know what I meant. Get over here. And then here comes the argument, and here comes the manipulation.
So that's interesting because, I mean, in one sense, the could you please just sounds like being polite, you know, just not being too authoritarian. You're saying that just putting those words together immediately opens up for, oh, could. This is a nice sort of idea.
And you know what? 80% of our children will not go there. They'll understand that you are being polite.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it only takes one child in every class to ruin your day. If you have one student that will take you there every time you use one of those statements, it gets to be a long day.
And that disturbs the whole class.
Well,
I
of course. Yes.
And luckily in university, we carry on gaily regardless right, of whatever's going on in class. You throw a few people out for texting and reading, but in an elementary school or a high school, that could cause major issues.
Well, we don't have those options there. You know, you teach what's in your classroom.
Yes.
And what happens is the rest of the class becomes very discouraged because even if they have somebody that's the class clown and they get the teacher off track, bird trail, what have you, after a while, that's not funny anymore because now the kids are realizing, you know what, we have a lot of homework because this kid keeps taking the teacher off track and the teacher assigns the remainder of that lesson as homework. All of a sudden also, we talk about once a teacher gets upset, if a student pushes a teacher to where there's an argument and the teacher's now stressed, there's an argument, even if you kick that child out of the class, the child legitimately has to go to the office now because they disrupted your class so severely that you cannot teach. And they do this.
Right.
When the student leaves, the class is still on edge because the students are concerned that who is that teacher going to yell at next, because that teacher now is loaded for bear. So my strategies, we don't teach teachers or parents how to stop arguments. We believe if you've started the argument, it's going to get there. We teach them how to never go there. Once we identify that a child's attempting to manipulate us through statement or through action, we go into our paradoxical responses of, thank you for sharing, bummer.
Right,
when I was a teacher, if a student came up to me and said, Mr. Mitchell, or yo, Mitch, well, my friends would say, yo, Mitch, or sometimes things that rhyme with that. But
yo, panel, I don't think I'm prepared for that.
Well, at the middle school, trust me, I still have my scars. But they would come up and say, hey, yo, Mitch. And I'd look at them very calmly, and I'd say, excuse me.
And you're a big lad.
I got a few size here. But they would stop, and they'd say, oh, Mr. Mitchell, how you doing? I'd say, I'm doing just fine. See, I did not – one of the issues that we had talked about earlier, we have to get our teacher and our parents to realize I'm not your friend. We have too many adults attempting to become friends with the children, and unfortunately, two things happen. Every time you become a child's friend, first, you lose your adult status. And when that child needs an adult answer, they're going to walk right past you. Okay? And the second thing, which is even worse – is they will begin to treat you like a friend. If you think for a second, how do they treat their friends? They're not very polite to their friends.
I know.
And the minute they're not polite to a teacher, the teacher takes that as being disrespectful, and now the child is kind of confused. I thought we were friends.
So the bottom line here is there's a constant statement of authority, and then it's not just a blind pig-like authority. It's just that you're telling the student, the child, this is what is expected. And then you leave it at that. So you don't explain why it's expected.
Well,
that's something that I'm not quite sure I know how to handle myself.
Well, let me say it this way. We talk about redirect and get out. Then you come back later and explain. There's got to be a teachable moment.
Okay.
With no consequences, there's no learning.
All right.
We have to hold kids accountable for their behavior. We have a poster that we like to put up in the classroom from the teacher to the students, kind of a teacher's creed, as it were. And it basically just says, I'm not going to do anything that's not in your best interest or in the best interest of the class. So every time we do something in that class, it's always for the students' or the class' best interest.
And in a sense, then, you're saying that there has to be a teachable moment, but it doesn't have to be at the moment of the instruction, if you like, or the edict.
Right, because if you attempt to give the instruction at the time of the offense, that's called an argument.
Right, no, I see. But then the other fallback position is, because I said so, now this is a parent. I presume teachers do this too?
We all do. Yeah. We all do. And what that is, if you do not know what you're going to do and say when you're being manipulated, you'll fall back to that.
Right.
Because it's an emotional response, fight or flight. What we teach...
That can't be your, what was it, banal and... The BAM.
The BAM
expression.
Is bizarre and meaningless,
okay.
Exactly.
Bizarre and meaningless, banal and meaningless. It doesn't matter, right?
Right, it doesn't
matter. But could
matter.
That be because I said so?
Well, let me say this. I do have teachers that will use things like that, and there are certain teachers that have the personality they can get away with it. What I tell my teachers, use whatever BAM statement you want as long as it has the effect that we're looking for, and that is de-escalating the event.
Yeah, so I told you to do it, or because I said so, is not going to de-escalate.
Oh, I have teachers that say, because I'm the queen. You know, and that, right. And people, I had one that came up, and a student had walked up to one of the teachers and said that, you know, you are a very nasty person. Just walked right up to her and said, you're a nasty person. And a teacher, what normal person, a normal response would be, well, you know what, you can't say that, or I don't care, or up, you know, all that stuff, right? But instead, she went paradoxical and blew his mind. She says, oh, sweetheart, I'm so glad you learned that early. Now go sit down and tell your friends.
Okay, so this, so we're getting a whole generation of teachers that are adopting this sort of a process, and parents, I suppose.
There are
you go around the country, you give these presentations, and they're very highly regarded and very entertaining. So you're getting a lot of disciples.
Yes. There's another man that we were consultants together for a while, and now he's doing his own thing out in California, Noah Salzman. He's wonderful with this program. You know, he has his own firm out there, and he does a wonderful job in California. There's a lot of schools out there, and they're adopting this style of, you know what, if I get upset, if I go fight or flight, you know what, students, that's not in your best interest for me to lose my cool. So I'm going to learn how not to lose my cool.
And why is this not going to be then somehow in the curriculum for educating teachers?
I would say that districts are embracing this more and more because it's a very positive-based discipline. Because we don't get in arguments, so it's very good for the students, and we set the expectations and of this nature. I am starting to get more universities looking at the book that I've written because they know that they're sending these young teachers out there and they're not as equipped in the area of discipline as they'd like to be.
I have a pet peeve about education. I am forbidden by law. I don't know whose law, but I've just been told numerous times that if I'm teaching a class and at the end of the semester or in the middle of the semester I give an exam, whether it's oral or written, I cannot post the results outside my office or anywhere else for that matter. I can't use social security numbers, but I want to use names. I grew up in a system where a student knew that when they did their exam or whatever it was, their task, that that would be graded. And the grade would be posted. And I'm convinced that that was a great driving force for a better performance. And yet here, it's just totally illegal. Could you just talk to that for a moment?
Well, let me say this. First of all, I share your pet peeve. What is happening since the 60s, 70s, 80s, and to today, and it's happening more and more, is we are sheltering these students from consequences of their actions. They make certain decisions not to study. They make certain decisions not to perform. And what ends up happening is that we're sheltering them from the consequence of that.
But why?
Well, I think that people, and I don't know who at this point, because we all say, but those people. But there are people in society that believe that it's detrimental to students to have them, you know, publicly humiliated. But actually, I don't see that as a public humiliation. I see that as, you know what, your name could be up there with an A. And if you know your name's going to be up there, then maybe you'll work harder for that A.
But who can change that? Can school districts, can they change that policy?
I'll tell you what, it is so inbred now in the schools that I believe strongly that that's going to have to come from a parent. I think the PTA is a very strong, great organization, PTOs. They're going to have to do it because it's really the parents who were advocates for their children. And without realizing it, I think that they've backed into a bad situation.
Okay. Well, we've backed into a bad situation. We've run out of time. Dennis Mitchell, education consultant, Dallas, Texas. Thank you so much for being here on Science Studio.
Thank you for letting me come in here and to voice my message. I've enjoyed talking, and I hope we get a chance to do it again.
Absolutely. And thank you, Norma Martinez, for putting this program together. Thank you for the audience out there. And if you need more information, of course, there is a website.
It's www.ignconsulting.com.
Take care. Bye-bye.